call to order this meeting of the Education Sub of Ways and Means. And Tim, tell us what we're doing.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, today we have the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and the mission of the board is to protect citizens of Oregon by setting a strong standard of practice and ethics through regulation of social workers. There are no CSL issues with the board. The CSL is roughly 6 to 7% above legislative approved budget from 13-15. There is a 10% increase in fees that will go towards bolstering the board's ending fund balance. And there are no issues with the co-chair's budget framework. So with that, I will turn it over to Randy Harnish with the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and also from DAS is Claire Clark.
Welcome, Randy.
Good morning again. Chairs Monroe and Comp, members of the committee, my name is Randy Harnish. I'm the actual executive director of the Board of Licensed Social Workers. And with me is Claire Clark from DAS, who's I want to acknowledge here has been a valuable asset to our little agency in helping us deal with this process. And so I really wanted to thank her and their staff for the work that they've done, as well as LFO and working. And it's very, very helpful to be able to go somewhere for assistance, particularly when you have a tiny little staff like we do. So we very much appreciate their help. The Board of Licensed Social Workers is a consumer protection agency similar to the two boards that we talked about yesterday. This board is a bit unusual in that it has the features of a practice act as well as a title act. We have license categories that fall into both of those types, and I'll go into that detail a little bit more. But I wanted to give you a kind of an example of what a social worker might be. And this is from our personal experience. My father passed away a little over a year ago, and it was really, I was working for the Board of Social Workers at the time, but I hadn't really crossed paths knowingly with a social worker until that event. And he was in an assisted living facility, and when doctors and family realized that that the end was near, we were introduced to a social worker who was on the staff of a hospice. And that individual, our interactions were brief and over a short period of time, but intensely valuable and extremely useful and helpful and supportive to the family, which I think is exactly the definition of what a social worker does, which is to provide those mental health services, but in the context of relationships and society at large. She helped us find the resources for transportation, those mundane things, as well as to provide the kind of the personal support to the family as we were going through this process. And so that was my experience on a personal note working with a social worker, and that will stick with me for the rest of my life. It was brief and intense and extremely helpful. And the social worker board has two functions, the same as all health regulatory boards, which is first to set standards and issue licenses for the professional practice of social work. And second, and I don't like using this word in the context of our work, but it really is to enforce those standards and license requirements, to ensure that clinical social workers are licensed and that they give the clients of the social workers a place to go if they feel that they've been mistreated or if they've received inappropriate services or inappropriate behavior. The Social Workers Board consists of seven members, prior to January 1st, 2015, the requirement in statute was that we had 4 clinical social workers and 3 public members. The law in 2013, House Bill 2082, changed that configuration to require 3 clinical social workers and 1 from one of our other license categories. To distinguish between clinical and the other categories, clinical social workers are those who work with clients face-to-face, who are actually providing mental health services to an individual. The non-clinical social workers, and I'll go through those license types in an upcoming slide, non-clinical social workers are those who provide, who maybe work in education, the study of social work, teaching social work, managing cases, or organizing clinics. But they don't necessarily work face-to-face with clients. Currently, we have 1 vacancy in a public member position, and we're working with the governor's staff to identify folks to fill that vacancy. We have 6 FTE in our staff. We have the executive director. We have a compliance specialist, an investigator 2, a program analyst, an office specialist 2, and an office specialist 1. And just to give you an idea of kind of the turnover, of those 6 folks, the compliance specialist 2 and the program analyst 2 have been in the office for more than 5 years. All the other 4, I started in July of 13. The others were after I arrived. So we're fairly new. The 4 license types, we have clinical licenses, which I mentioned are the ones that deal with individuals face-to-face, the licensed clinical social worker, and the clinical social work associate. The clinical social work associate can be considered as kind of the on-ramp to full licensed clinical social worker status, which is kind of the ultimate license in our office. The clinical social work associate can provide that face-to-face service, but under the supervision of a licensed clinical social worker. So it's more of a akin to an internship. That license type became mandatory by action of the legislature in 2009, so that the clinical social workers are those licenses that are a Practice Act statute. You cannot practice clinical social work without being licensed. The other 2 licenses are Title Act licenses, and that's the Registered Baccalaureate Social Worker and the Licensed Master Social Worker. Those are voluntary, but that Title Act protects the title. It permits someone to use that title, which gives the public the knowledge and the assurance that person has met educational and experiential requirements in order to do the job. Those 4 license categories took effect January 1st, 2011. Our license base continues to grow. I think I have a jump ahead here. You can see in 2009 and 10, we had no Master Social Worker or RBSW because that license hadn't taken effect. And then in 2011, when those licenses were being issued, we started seeing folks apply and obtain those licenses. The clinical social worker prior to 2011 was a voluntary license. It was a Title Protection Act. After 2011, it was a Practice Act, and so anyone who was practicing had to come in and be licensed. So we saw a bit of an uptick in clinical social worker licenses issued at that point as well. Sorry. Let's see. There we go. And you can see right in the center of that graph, the steepest portion of the graph, that's in 2011 when we started seeing the voluntary licenses and the now mandatory clinical licenses kind of start showing up in our roles. And things that we've tried to do to address the increased workload. You may notice a bit of a similarity between some of the slides yesterday. We tried to, that's part of our efficiencies, is to, you know, divide and conquer, use the resources as often as we can. But we have also implemented online licenses, which has significantly helped out in our processing of licenses in the office. We also use attestation and audit for collecting continuing education. We converted our licensed clinical social workers from an annual to a biennial license, which serves a couple purposes. It reduces the workload, and it increases and stretches out the income over a two-year period, with the renewals on birth month rather than at a single point at the end of the year. We use secure iPads for all of our board communications. We have now fully staffed our compliance and investigative function, which is has been extremely, the benefit has been very noticeable over the last 4 months since we've had people in both of our investigative staff positions. And we are currently working with an IT contractor to implement full online licensure, both initial and renewal. We have seen complaints continue to increase. I will say that in this biennium, 2013-15, our numbers are not climbing as dramatically as they had been in the past. And whether that's just anecdotal or a fluke, I don't know if that's going to continue. Certainly the trend has been since the early 2000s to grow, and so I don't expect that it's going to drop off. This may be just a kind of a momentary lapse, but so far in 2013-15, they're not climbing as dramatically or radically as they had been in the past. And as a fee-based, other-funded agency, we are fully, our expenses and our income are fully a function of the number of licensees that we have. And our licensees are increasing. But with the increased number of licensees comes a continuing a regular source of complaints. And we also, as everyone observes, we have continued increasing personnel costs, legal costs, and general government costs. I will mention again that the Social Workers Board has also executed a flat rate agreement with the Department of Justice to help us kind of make more regular our legal expenses throughout the year. We have are proposing a 10% fee increase for our four license category renewals. And just to give you an idea of what that would look like, and with the exception of one, are two-year licenses. The LCSW is $260 every 2 years. That would increase under this proposal to $286. The RBSW is a two-year license. Would go from $100 to $110. The licensed master social worker is also a two-year license. It would increase from $200 to $220. The CSWA, the clinical social work associate, is a one-year license, and it would increase from $60 per year to $66 per year. And that fee increase really would fund our ending fund balance. And with Claire's advice, I saw the wisdom of making sure that we are able to end the biennium with a healthy balance so that we, A, can cover expenses that are unforeseen, and also be ready to build into the 17-19 budget. With this fee increase, we would not expect to have to come back and ask for an additional fee increase before 17-19. It does sound like a long time. Now, I have to say, this is the part of the presentation that I don't want to have to give, but we had a, in looking at our performance measures, we have a target for resolving complaints to resolve 85% of them within 6 months. We've not been able to make that. And in 2014, we dropped off the charts, and it was kind of shocking. And I wanted to be able to explain, at least in my analysis, where that came from. And I don't want to get ahead of myself. In 2009, we had the first limited duration compliance position. So prior to that, the board actually did their own investigations and wrote the final orders. In 2011, the legislature approved the compliance position as permanent and added a half-time limited duration investigator. In 2013, you approved a full-time permanent investigator position. Now, unfortunately, or fortunately for the mother of twins, we had our compliance specialist take maternity leave in the middle of all of this, and we were functioning for a period of time with a limited duration agency rotation person and a brand new half-time investigator, and my tale of woe. The investigator position did not work out and was vacant from March of 2014 through October of 2014. We've now filled that position. We've added and have been working with a contract investigator. So I think I can safely say we are have unplugged the bottleneck, and things are moving through the process more rapidly. So I hope to be able to report back in 2017 that we've fixed that problem. But right now we are fixing the problem. Now, one of the things
Senator Thompson has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So do you think that attributes to that 23% on the chart previous to that, because it wasn't there, or either your bar is way too high, or you just you can't do those within 6 months. Do you solve those within 8 months, 12 months, or do you give up at some point and they're never resolved? What's beyond those 6 month numbers?
Co-chairs and Senator Thompson, I think absolutely the 23% is a function of that staffing issue, and that we are moving cases through much more rapidly and predictably than we had been in the past because of the additional staffing. To your question about the timeline, the cases, it really depends on the complexity of the case. Now, I want to make sure that we all understand, that you understand, that we triage those cases when they come in. And the two that get the highest priority in our office are the ones that are truly urgent and serious. Those get bumped to the top of the list, and if we have to do an emergency suspension or revocation, that's exactly what happens. And those will happen within that 180 days. The ones that are the other priority are applications. If you have an individual who is applying for his or her professional license, they're waiting for us to do our work so that they can get a job. Sometimes applicants on their application will self-identify that they've had some kind of a criminal history. More often than not, that criminal history is driving under the influence back in, or possession of something when they were in college. And because they've identified it, we have to open a case. Those cases are also prioritized because we don't want to stop that individual from entering the profession, assuming that the board determines that this is a situation that we can take action on and move them forward. It's the cases that are in the middle that, once we finish the urgent ones and the application ones, that we can need to focus time on to keep those moving through. And our goal is to try to get as many of them as we can within that 180 days, knowing that that's not always going to be the case. And sometimes it takes a year and a half, simply because they're complicated. We have to call lots of witnesses. There has to, sometimes we have to have expert witnesses. So.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, along that same line, it would be interesting to see kind of a scatter graph or a deal, number of complaints and timeline showing when they got finished for a particular year, so we could have a sense of whether the 6 months is unrealistic, but also a sense of truly where, how do they spread out over the year. I mean, from my perspective, his question is really about, are we setting appropriate standards? Could more people make it go quicker, or what? And then eventually have a conversation about what are the limiting factors to this kind of stuff, if we're really going to try to resolve them in a better timeline. That's just me at some point.
Yeah, it looks like from that other chart you showed us that until this last year, when everything bottom fell out, you were averaging about 60-65%, and your goal is 85.
Right.
That's not so terribly far off what your goal, but this last year was a disaster.
And your N is not very large, because I saw your total number of total number of complaints is in the 60 range. So,
okay. Representative Taylor?
Yeah, I just wanted to understand. Oh, thank you, Senator Monroe. What are if you could talk a little bit about the types of complaints, and then if you think there's a correlation, are you tracking that? I happen to just know that for some of the other boards, for example, the nursing board and the medical board, they put them into categories of what the types of complaints are. And then I was wondering, since you added these additional licenses, is if there's a certain type of profession, a certain type of licensed individuals, that group, if you're getting more complaints in one category than another. So.
Co-chairs and Representative Taylor, clearly the complaints come with the clinical social workers. The two other licenses, the Masters of Social Work and the Registered Baccalaureate Social Worker, don't interact individually with clients, and so they generate very few complaints. Mm-hmm. By and large, the biggest chunk come from the clinical social workers. Mm-hmm. And to give you an example, the types of complaints that we get are, kind of. I'll give some examples. Dual relationships. And dual relationships would define that a therapist, a clinical social worker working with an individual on a mental health issue is in the relationship where they're in a position of authority and influence, and our ethics guidelines make that very specific, that they cannot use that relationship to their advantage financially. They can't enter into a physical relationship with a client. Those sorts of dual relationships form the basis of many, many of our complaints. Those are complicated complaints to investigate because it involves, individual perceptions of the type of relationship. It can also be financial relationships. A therapist and a client can't go into business together. There are a lot of complaints that have to do with billing, inappropriate billing. And the other category that oftentimes we see complaints is social workers provide a service for couples who are going through divorce to evaluate the family situation to determine the custody of children. And those custody studies very often result, well, not very often, almost always result in someone thinking that they've got the short end, they're getting the bad result. They're not happy with the result. Those custody studies also often end up with, we see many complaints.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
So I'm trying to understand, so then when you are tracking the types of complaints, and then I guess this also pertains to when you were talking yesterday about the therapists and about the marriage and family counselors, and is there a cycle where this information is presented to the board and that perhaps standards should be changed so that folks understand, I mean, this seems to be, if we're having a pattern of complaints increasing, although it would be efficient to add more employees to reduce them, but of course the commonsensical solution would be, let's try to reduce the number of complaints. So,
Co-chairs and Representative Taylor, an example of that is the board is in the process of adopting an administrative rule to set standards for the individuals who are providing custody evaluations.
Okay.
To do exactly what you described.
Okay.
To make sure that we've set the requirements for those individuals so that their clients know exactly what to expect and what this person's going to provide, and knows going into the process what is involved and what the possible outcomes would be. So I would hope that we are trying to do exactly what you describe,
mm-hmm,
by reviewing and developing this new administrative rules.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
All right. Okay. The other measurement that I wanted to at least to identify has to do with our customer service, and we're not as far off, but we've, for the same reason, we've had any staff turnover since I've been at the board. We have one consistent member who's been there that predated me, and we rely on her for a lot. And however, as valuable and as competent as she is, she can't do everything. And we now are fully staffed in our licensing and our administrative staff. And so, again, I would hope and I expect to see that these numbers will improve over the upcoming biennium. The other measures that we have to do with continuing education and best board practices, and we have not had any issues with those. And then the bills that we are following, the Senate Bill 230, having to do with the demographic data, which we discussed yesterday, Senate Bill 289, and the agency introduced or developed a legislative concept that became House Bill 2473, which would authorize the board to issue temporary licenses. And this is another example. We had a problem with, particularly with the CSWAs, the Certified Social Work Associate, in that the requirements kind of put these recent grads into a kind of a catch-22 feedback loop, which said they have to develop a plan of supervision in order to get their certificate of social work associate. And the plan of supervision is they've got to identify a licensed clinical social worker, and they have to create this kind of work experience document and explain to us how this is going to be monitored and who the players are and submit this. Well, in order to do one of these, a plan of supervision, it kind of assumes that you have a job. The employers won't hire someone until they have a license or a certificate. So it previously or currently, it's a matter of trying to create these two things simultaneously and then execute them kind of at the same time. It's kind of like closing on a house. You have to get everybody together to sign at exactly the same time in order to make this work. And it's extremely inefficient and unfair to these clinical social work associates who are trying to get a job, and the employers that can't hire until they know that they've someone with a license. So what we've proposed is authorize the board to create a temporary or a provisional status kind of in between the individual finishing the program, getting their master's of social work, and allow them kind of this interim period to develop a plan of supervision with a provisional license that would immediately become a certificate of social work associate as soon as they get the plan together and their job arranged. We talked to the professional associations. They thought that was a great idea. It was one of our most frequent complaints from licensees, which was, how can I do this? And so we've put this this bill in, and it's been filed. We haven't seen that it's been scheduled for hearing yet, but we think it really could be a very simple and a zero cost fix to our current problem, simply because this would become just a step in our existing license kind of flow chart. So those are the bills that we're at this point looking at.
Questions?
I just had one question. Thank you,
yes,
Senator
Monroe.
Regarding the IT systems, so there's going to sounds like you're trying to move to an automated system, which I think has been years in coming. And so there's going to be a separate one for the therapists, for the counselors in marriage, and the family counselors, and then there's a third one for the social workers, or will they all be the same?
Co-chairs and Representative Taylor, can you?
For the IT mm-hmm. system, for the to track to so people can get their license and renew their license online, will the company that you're contracting with, is that one company that's going to do all of those together, or is this going to be three separate contracts with three separate software packages purchased?
Co-chairs and Representative Taylor, at this point, it's the same individual. It's the same IT provider that we're
mm-hmm.
currently working
right.
with. I really, because of our co-location, we're all in the same building.
Right, yeah.
I hope that we can make happen a common product.
Okay.
Because it really does not make sense for three of us to develop three separate systems.
Follow-up, Senator Morrell. I've been to your office in the past and noticed that you're all there on the same floor, and it seems that it would make sense for tracking data for license for efficiency reasons to, and since my understanding is you contract with the same individual, what are the roadblocks in order and what can we do to maybe help you make that happen?
Co-chairs and Representative Taylor, I think...
Help flesh that out.
Okay.
I think I hear exactly what you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I think just including that in the record is will give us some leverage in working with those other two boards, and the new director who's will be coming on the end of the month to see the wisdom in kind of moving forward cooperatively rather than going off in a. In separate directions.
Follow up, just for the record, I'm not saying that you should necessarily do that. I'm just asking what are the roadblocks, and it's more of a question, is it a good idea to do that?
Co-chairs and Representative Field, I think it is a good idea to do that. The roadblocks really are that we are three separate agencies, and so we'll have to have three separate contracts simply because of that arrangement.
And Mr. Walker wants to help you out.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I've been with LFO since 2007 and working with the small boards and commissions, and this has been a constant problem. Part of the problem is DAS has not dictated or identified a consistent platform for all these boards and commissions. I mean, at the end of the day, the boards and commissions, all it is a database, and they're either tracking nurses, doctors, or licensed social workers. So there's been no consistency, and it's hard to get everybody herded in the same direction to agree on standards and how they're going to track. Some of the directors may decide, well, I want it to look like this, and somebody else may want it to look like this. So getting everybody to agree on those IT standards to get a consistent platform for everybody has really been a challenge. There are products out there that can be modified. They're essentially off the shelf that can be used. But again, some folks may want red and some may want purple, and they don't come in the same package. So this has been a long-term problem.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I guess I think we're at a opportune moment. I think you could have a conversation with the directors of the other two programs. And the current director could talk to himself and have a conversation with each of the boards to explain what happened here and why we think it makes sense to come up with a common deal. And then if and when they get a new director, that current director could talk to those people and maybe have a common conversation. Because I think, I agree, every board sees their own uniqueness. We've seen how they've been assigned and the appointment. And each one of those people thinks that they are a unique and distinct place, and they want to have their little fingerprint on it. And if it can save them money, time, and effort, I hope we can have that conversation with the boards before they make that final decision, because it makes only sense to do this. And again, since you're in the same places, it even makes more sense. And there's never, you never know when another director may leave and a person may be the acting director for multiple ones of these agencies, and it would be helpful if they had an understanding of how the process works. So I just would encourage that.
Good. Additional? Okay, are we ready to go to Claire? Okay, Claire.
Okay. All right, good morning. This morning, for the record, Co-Chairs Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. My name is Claire Clark from the Chief Financial Office in the Department of Administrative Services. Thank you, Randy. So I will, again, give a brief overview of the governor's budget for the Board of Licensed Social Workers. This budget ensures that the board has the resources it needs to maintain services at the current level. There we go. The Board of Licensed Social Workers is also situated in the public safety outcome area of the 10-year plan for Oregon. It contributes to the public safety vision by providing consumer protections and ensuring patients receive high-quality services and appropriate treatments. Here you can see the board's expenditures from 2011-13 through the 2015-17 governor's budget, as well as the FTE for the board over time. The increase in expenditures and FTE from 2011-13 through 2013-15 is from an increase of an investigator position from half-time to full-time. And then you can see from the current biennium to the 2015-17 governor's budget, there's just a slight increase of $16,000. So this increase is so small because the board has achieved significant savings without reducing the services to its licensees through those operational efficiencies that Randy was able to outline earlier. So again, this chart displays the revenues for the board over time. This board is also a 100% other funded agency. It receives its revenues through licensing and renewal fees charged to professional social workers. On this chart, you'll notice that there's a large increase from 2009-11 to 2011-13, and this increase is tied to that expansion of the board's authority where they could mandate the licensure of those practicing clinical social work and the voluntary regulation of those practicing non-clinical social work. So after this expansion of the board's authority, as you've already seen, there was an increase in the number of licensees and two new licenses came into existence, and these are tied to the additional revenue between those two bienniums.
Can
question either.
Yeah.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the previous page said that the increase was only $16,000, and this shows an increase of $122,000. So how do those coincide? How does that make sense?
Sure. In 2000, co-chairs, Senator Roblin, in 2013, the legislature approved increasing an investigator position from half-time to full-time.
Okay.
And at that time, it was understood that the cost of that extra time would decrease the board's ending balance, and that a fee increase would be necessary to continue to cover those costs in this biennium and future biennia.
And so did we end with a balance at the end of the that was below the 4 months, and now we're going to try to get it back up to that critical mass of 4 months of time at the end of the year?
Co-Chair Senator Roblin, I don't have the figures for the end of this biennium's budget, but I do know that when I was doing my analysis, looking at the CSL budget for the Board of Licensed Social Workers at the current fee level, they would not have had enough ending balance for the end of 2015-17. So I think that covers a bit of what I was going to say. So the as mentioned, the 10% increase in renewal fees will add approximately $122,000 in revenue. And for this biennium, it'll leave an ending balance of $324,000, which is about 5.5 months of operating expenses. So as Randy has already mentioned, the fees were last increased in July of 2009. And this fee increase will cover the cost of that investigator position for 2015-17 and is expected to cover costs through 2017-19. So in short, the governor's budget for the Board of Licensed Social Workers covers current expenses, it reflects savings resulting from those operational efficiencies, and it includes that 10% increase in license fees. And that's everything I have today, and I welcome any questions.
Questions for Claire? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Walker.
I have nothing. I'm done.
Anything for the good of the order?
I just have a quick little question. Been doing some research. We got a note from Doug Wilson and LFO. Came up with current school service level of $7.265 billion. And the co-chair's budget, the early co-chair's budget, was about $30 million less than that. So are the co-chairs aware of this? Because this was something we asked for. Are the co-chairs aware of that? And are we going to be working with a little higher budget? Or are we still going to be at that $7.235 billion?
We really haven't got into that yet. What we've looked at is the comparison between the governor's proposed budget and the co-chair's budget. And that difference is about $300 million. Mm-hmm. Again, when we get there, we'll have plenty of opportunity to discuss what the appropriate level is or how much money is available and so on and so forth. It's always difficult. Everybody wants finite money, whether it be for K-12 or for community colleges or for universities or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we'll have every opportunity to commiserate on those decisions, although the big co-chairs actually usually end up making the final decision.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? Yeah, pray that I get over this cold.
Hope you get feeling better, Rod.
Yeah, okay. Take care.
We will adjourn.
Unplug me.
We will adjourn. Unplug.